On tonight's program, ladies and gentlemen, we have something that's going to make you sick.
Hello and welcome back to Two Truths of the Brian. My name is Takunda Gumbu. I'm here with my co-host, Dylan Huber. And today we're joined by a special guest, Peter Wood, who is a Zimbabwean, who is also a podcaster. He's got a podcast called Mud in Between Your Toes. Peter, before we go into today, can you just maybe introduce yourself and tell us why Mud Between Your Toes?
Well, firstly, Dylan and Takunda, thank you for inviting me onto your program, Two Truths at a Braai. Very excited to be talking to you two guys, especially to ex-Prince Edward boys. look, Mud Between Your Toes, the podcast series started out after I'd written a book, a memoir about my life growing up in Zimbabwe. And the book started life after I'd written a series of diaries all through my school days. You know, back in the 1970s, we did silly things like that. We wrote diaries, and most of my friends threw their diaries away, but I happened to keep mine. And it was years before I actually opened those diaries again. I mean, probably 25 years before I actually bothered opening them again. And I suddenly saw this life that we had lived, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I thought, well, you know, I think it's time to write about this. And that's what I did. So I wrote the memoir. And after I finished the book, someone said to me, look, you know, people want to hear more. And the beauty of a podcast is that you can bring in all the kind of outtakes that you didn't put into the book. So the podcast series began. I actually did three series on Mud Between Your Toes. The first series was essentially just me reading from the book, very badly, I might add. And then, you know, very amateur dramatics. And then the second series, I started interviewing Zimbabweans from all walks of life. You know, people who just had an interesting story to tell. And then the third series, I opened it up to the whole world. I just decided anyone who had a good story to tell. If they had an Africa connection, that was fantastic. But if not, I still went for it. So that's how it all started.
That's interesting. You mentioned diaries. I think these days we don't have written diaries, like physical diaries, but we now have notes on the phone. People note down a lot of things on the phone. So I think we still have diaries, just electronic ones nowadays.
Well, you have Instagram and you have your TikTok and all that kind of thing that you can refer back to. And it's all very instant. I think what was interesting about this is that those diaries had been put into storage, and literally I wasn't even in possession with them. A friend of mine who was a journalist for Reuters, for some strange reason, he was an ex-Prince Edward guy, but he ended up looking after those diaries, and those diaries went all around the world with him, you know, Indonesia, Middle East, you know. And then finally he got back to London. He said, look, you know, I don't want to keep these things. They seem too precious. So he gave them to me. And once again, they sat there for another year. And then I sort of one day, a little bit bored, a little bit interested, you know, opened them up. And I thought, oh my God, look at this. it wasn't all very flattering, I might add as well, you know.
Well, that's how a diary is supposed to be, right? It's not supposed to be all flattering. It's the truth, right? Sometimes the truth is written in gray sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I loved writing the book because the book, it transported me back to that time. And a lot of the things that had happened, I had forgotten or I had deliberately put out of my mind, you know, particularly some of the less, you know, the less nice things that had happened to me. And I kind of stopped thinking about them. And when you go back, and the world has moved on, you know, and you go back and you look at these things and you start questioning, could you have done it differently? You know, the world was a very different place in the 1970s. And as you know, our country was a totally different place back then. I mean, you know, we tend to look back at these sort of, we look back, I mean, 40 years difference, remember. We look back with rose-tinted spectacles often, and that can be a little bit, that can be a little bit dangerous, I think. You know, because yes, I grew up in a very privileged lifestyle, you know, big house, swimming pool, servants, something that anyone anywhere else around the world would be incredibly jealous about. But then there was all, you know, throughout the diaries, you know, there was this civil war that was going on and people were dying. It was, you know, people on both sides, thousands of people died. And it doesn't matter how you try and paint the picture. It doesn't matter how you try and spin the story. I think when you grow up in that kind of environment, doesn't matter how privileged you are or not, it you know, it affects you and it affects the whole community and the whole society. And I think no more so than it did in Rhodesia. I think that we were as a people very, and I'm sure there'll be some people listening to this who will, might get angry with me, but I think we were very insular. We put these shields up, these barriers against the rest of the world. We couldn't stand criticism from the rest of the world. You know, anyone who criticized us was considered liberal press, liberal media, you know, you know, and as a teenager, this all affects you. You know, teenagers are very, you know, they're affected by everything that's going on around them and they soak it up. And yeah, so that was the a sort of little snapshot of the upbringing. You know, just the good, the bad, and the ugly, as I said earlier.
Yeah. Okay, so I think now, we don't delve too much into the podcast. It's something that we do here. We have what we call moral dilemmas. Dylan is going to like just explain to you what the moral dilemma is. So we're going to hit the moral dilemma. Then we'll come back and we can tell you a story more. I think I find it quite interesting because when you were born and when you were living in Zimbabwe, it wasn't called Zimbabwe then. It was Rhodesia. And it still had like a segregated political system based on race, and there was a minor white minority. And for our listeners, obviously can't see you. You're actually white. And I think that also ties into what you're talking about not, building walls and around yourselves and not wanting to be called liberals, etc. Let's pause there. Let's just dive into the moral dilemma, which is of course tied into the topic. And then we'll come back to that. I think it's quite interesting because you talk about things that happened in the 1960s, 1970s that we are kind of experiencing right now as well. So Dylan,
We don't know that. We don't know that. That's what we'll find out later, because when you talk about experience, it's all from a perspective, right? So you never know if we actually went through it or are going through it, or which one's worse and which one's better. But let's go into the moral dilemma first. Let's free ourselves. Let's not try to think too much first. Yet.
Okay. Yet. I wait with bated breath.
Thank you. Let's go. Right. So today's moral dilemma is going to be a bit different. Right. I'm going to assign certain categories to each one of us, and each one of us has to defend that side that I'm giving you. Okay. So that's a bit different. We're in a sinking boat. Okay. Yes. We're in a sinking boat. One of us, I'm going to give this to Takunda. Takunda, you are an adult, meaning that you're between 40 to, how old is an adult? 40 to 60, right? That's an adult. And then Mr. Wood, you're an adolescent. And I am I am an elderly person, so I'm between 61 and older. Yes, we are okay. All three of us are in a sinking ship, and now we have to give reasons as to why we deserve to live. Only one gets to live. Okay, only one gets to live, but we have to give reasons as to why we deserve to. So I'm elderly. I think it's going to be harder for me to defend myself. Mr. Wood, you're an adolescent. And then Takunda, you are an adult. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now I'm going to start with Mr. Takunda. Why do you deserve to live and we deserve to die? I'm going to put that in the harshest way possible.
Okay. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, if I'm between 40 and 60, I probably have young kids who are below the age, let's say I'm closer to my 40s, so I probably have young kids who are below the ages of 10, 5, 6, 7. So I would say they need a caregiver and I need to be there for them. So that's why I need to leave. And like you, Dylan, who's above 60, you already have grandkids, you've seen a lot of the world, and your children are probably adults. So they don't need you as much as my children.
Wow, they don't need me, he says.
Yeah, then I'll say to Mr. Wood, he's a young adolescent, he doesn't have kids, doesn't need to worry. There's no one who needs him if he dies.
That sounds
very harsh. It sounds very, very
it is harsh. It's offensive. I am offended.
It sounds very harsh. But I think if we're waiting, but at the end of the day, if you're going to defend why you have to leave whilst others die, It's a bit harsh and selfish at the end of the day. So allow me to be. I would say, maybe that's my children would be the reason why I have to leave to the exclusion of everyone else.
And Mr. Wood, why do you deserve to live?
Well, talk about moral dilemma. Look, as an adolescent, I am fitter than you two. I have my whole life. I have my whole life ahead of me. I can do so much more for the future. I'm not going to say I know more than you. That would be very arrogant, because you've had a whole lifetime you've had a lifetime of experiences. But and I'm going to be really selfish about this. You know, as a teenager, I'm going to say stuff you. I'm the one who's getting in that lifeboat. You know, you've had your life. It's time to move on.
No.
I do think that I could probably do more to help the other passengers who are in the water bobbing around than probably. Certainly, Dylan, you're the old toppy. I can do more than you.
But it's just the three of us, by the way. There's no one else, so that's it.
Okay, there's no
first
one
of
else,
all
well.
First of all, I'm gonna say I'm wiser than all of you, and we all know that the world needs guidance at the moment, and I'm not gonna get a teenager to guide the world, no offense, but the mistakes that teenagers make, they make too many mistakes, and so I know we learn from mistakes, but I don't think we need so many mistakes. Sometimes you just need that experience. If adolescents were that powerful enough to lead, I think we wouldn't be having old presidents. And people usually choose old presidents because they're wise and they know what they're doing. Adults, Takunda, you spoke about your children and your grandchildren. Isn't that the problem with adults? Sometimes you just need to care for everyone else but yourself. It sounds like you both are selfish, and we all know grandmothers and grandfathers are the least selfish in the family. And
Dylan, who put me in this position in the first place? Who was driving the ship that hit the iceberg? It wasn't the teenager. It was one of you guys.
The adults, right?
It was the adults, and you know. But you are right. You are wiser, no doubt.
Of course, I'm right.
You know, a teenager will not become a president. You know, rather, we've seen Lord of the Flies, and we saw what happened there. But it depends where I am in my teens. If I'm 19, then that's a different thing. If I'm 13, well, you know, it's a different story altogether.
Well, we'd like to believe it's a different story, but teenagers will always be teenagers. And when you're 19 and you're 13, you both start trying to experiment things and try things, isn't it? I mean, high school is between 13 to 18, and they're all put in the same box, and they're all told to live in a certain way. Adults are still trying to find, really, Takuna, you're going to be trying to find, you're going to be going through a midlife crisis when we need you the most. That doesn't make sense, does it?
Well, I think that you had time to think about your answer.
Yeah,
if I had more time to think about my answer,
I swear I didn't.
He did some serious research on his answer before he came.
All right, okay. All right, let's change it up a bit. Okay, now we have a baby. I'm going to give Takunda the baby. You're the baby. Why do you deserve to live? And then I will be, I'll be a kid between, how old is the baby? 2 to 5? Then I'll be a kid between 6 to 13. And then Mr. Wood, I'll give you elderly. So that's 3 people. Yes? Mm-hmm. Why do you deserve to live?
Well, who's going first? Is it me?
Mr. Wood, you can go first.
Well, then I'm going to answer your question. I'm going to say what you said. I'm wiser than you. The baby's not going to live. The baby's not going to survive. Sorry about that. As cruel as it is, the baby won't survive. But, you know, it's arguable even if the kid will survive. Although as an elderly person, you know,
You won't survive either.
I probably won't, yeah.
We all won't survive anyway. Takunda, what do you think?
I don't think I can say anything because the baby cannot even speak, so he can only even say reasons why he should leave. But it's very difficult for a baby because essentially the baby can't live by itself. So
no, I'm not defending you. I don't want babies to die, but what I'm saying is, you have an advantage of starting on a clean slate. If you're looking at the future of the world, I'd rather have babies. I don't want to defend you, but I'd rather have babies start because we live in a cruel and cold world. And, you know, babies are the ones who are non-discriminatory. Babies are the ones that don't know between black and white or good and bad and all that stuff, right? So we start from fresh. But continue.
I think I should have survived that one anyway.
Yeah. I can't find anything to defend the baby or to say this is why the baby should leave. Because even starting on a clean slate does not necessarily mean the baby's going to live a good life. So I don't know.
Yeah. But if we're not looking at the baby, we're looking at the perspective of the society. And well, I as a kid would prefer living because a baby, like you said, a baby wouldn't be able to survive. As a kid, I probably have a better chance or a better reason to live because I'm between the elderly and the baby, right? That means I'm learning, but I'm also fit and able to continue the journey and for years to come. Right?
But I can read the stars and get the lifeboat back to the mainland.
Yeah, for like 5 years, for like a few hours. And then you get tired, and then we have to feed you, and then we have to take care of you, and then we have to walk you. See,
Yeah, but I know where you guys have been left, and we can send a rescue party back to.
I think that's what's quite interesting. Can we live differently as people, as different generations? What roles do we play in each other's lives? I mean, should opportunities just be given to the young? Should the young be able to do whatever they want, and should much older generation to be able to say, whoa, stop right there, do this instead, or, you know, trying to curtail us. I think that just also ties into what we're talking about today. To come back to you, Peter, in our earlier conversation, you were talking about your diaries. Like you, in your bio, you say you were born in 1962 in Rhodesia. So yeah, I think maybe just tell us, what was it like to grow up as a young person in Rhodesia? To have your dreams, to see like this is what I want to do, this is what I want to do, this is the world around me. What was it like? I mean, we were born 40 odd years later, but what was it like for you then?
Yeah, it was. Look, it's a really interesting question because, firstly, I think a lot of adolescents, a lot of teenagers have the same dreams, regardless to whether it was the 1960s, 70s, or, you know, when you were growing up. Of course, circumstance changes everything. We can get into the whole sexuality thing in a minute, but that aside, I was a little bit rebellious because we were growing up in this kind of gilded cage where we were, you know, our passport didn't allow us to travel anywhere. So, we had this little world that we lived in. And my mum's sister, my aunt, and her husband were quite famous actors in the 50s and 60s in London. Really quite famous in their time. And they were also really liberal. She was born in Rhodesia. She hated Ian Smith. They would come out on holiday and they would stay with us. There would be these epic arguments between my father and them. And as a child, as a teenager, I was sitting listening and soaking all of this up. And I loved what they were doing with their lives. That is the life I wanted to live. You know, I wanted the flower power and the hippies. And, you know, they went off, you know, he went off to Kathmandu and did LSD with the Beatles. And, you know, and they would have dinner in London with all these famous film stars. And I was, it just fascinated me. And, so you're talking about aspirations, you know, boy, that was something to really aspire to. Not everyone in our family agreed, you see. I mean, my brother was the complete opposite. He didn't see what was so interesting about acting and, you know, famous people and everything. So we're all different. And also, of course, then getting back to the whole sort of sexuality thing, it was one of the hardest things to bear in many ways because you had no one to talk to. So you had no one to aspire to. The only, homosexual people you ever saw were almost like a parody. They were comics. They were very camp and limp-wristed. And it was, that's not what I was, you know. And I thought, well, what am I, you know? And I had no one to ask. And God forbid, as you well know, and it's probably no different now, I don't know, you just did not tell anyone. So you bottled it all up. So aspirations as a teenager, it was very mixed, very, very mixed. You know, and I think because of that, I became a bit of a rebel. I think it sort of forced me into pretending to be more of a rugged guy going out and bunking out of school and drinking and coming back on a Tuesday morning at 3 a.m. and, and then still managing to make it to class and still getting through. And, you know, and I think that I should point out here, and perhaps this is, this tells you how good a school Prince Edward was. I don't know. But despite all of that, I still managed to be in the A1 stream. Despite all of that, we were the youngest year ever at the time, it might have changed now, we were the youngest year ever to do O-level English Lit, English Language and Maths, and of which every single person in the class passed. I'm not sure what age we were, but I think everyone else was, you know, doing their mock O's and we were doing the real O's. So we were a year ahead of everyone else. So despite going out and being a rebel and tearing around town and, you know, I was still able to get things done. But that didn't mean I enjoyed school at all. I hated it. And I really, really hated school. And, you know, most of that was because I just couldn't wait to leave and discover myself. And you know, I knew that wasn't going to happen while I was at school. In fact, they politely asked me to leave. So in effect, I was expelled.
You expelled.
Politely, you were expelled politely.
Yeah, so I was expelled in January, so I'd probably only done 1 month for the A-level term.
A-level.
Yeah, and the headmaster called me in and said, look, you know, there's 1,000 kids out there that could take your position, you know, you're obviously not interested, so I'd like you to leave. Which is a really interesting thing, you know, when you think about it, because he should really have sat me down and said, what's the problem?
And said, what's wrong? Didn't.
Yeah, what's wrong? You know, try to figure that out rather than just kicking me out.
That's true.
And the funny thing is that, you know, I left, you know, with a smile on my face, but it's not a good thing. You know, it's not a good thing. Later in life, it comes back and haunts you. You know, you do need to do your A-levels. You do, you know, kids, if you're listening, do your A-levels.
In one of your podcasts, you talk about your love of art that you developed past years to Prince Edward, and how art was not viewed as one of the good subjects. So
yeah.
You loved art and drama, like you did mention, and you didn't go on. And today you mentioned about the headmaster saying, if you're not interested, then leave. There are other 1,000 kids that would take your place. I think that's also points out maybe during your time, which probably is the same, still a little bit the same in our time, where in our society here in Zimbabwe, there's very little guidance given to young people. It's more of just do, you know, make a decision. You think you're old enough, you think you ought to vote, you're 18, you're doing your A-level, so you ought to vote, so it's fine, make a decision. But there's very little guidance given.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, Tukunda, I was talking to some friends of mine in the UK who have teenage daughters, and the amount of guidance they have is quite extraordinary. Not once in all my school days, not one single time did a teacher sit down and ask me, there's something wrong here. Why is this kid rebelling? Because there's no reason. I was obviously good at school, but you know, why was that happening? Perhaps it's a Zimbabwean thing, perhaps it's an African thing, perhaps it's, you know, that whole, perhaps it's a Southern Hemisphere thing. I don't know. You know, we have a different way of looking at, you know, belt up, shut up and get on with it kind of thing. Exactly. But I wonder whether, I really do wonder whether I would have listened to anyone, you know, or whatever. I would have just thought, stuff you, I just want to get out. Or whether I would have lied to them. And I think that would have been the main thing. If they'd said, you know, if they'd even hinted, you know, whether was I gay, I would have said no. I would never have told someone in authority that I was. So perhaps the whole thing is a moot point anyway.
Right. I think it's quite interesting the way you put it, like it's a moot point anyway. And the fact that no one even asked that, why is this kid rebellious? Why does he have to act this in a different manner? And you did mention that it's sort of a Southern Hemisphere thing. I have a friend who is Vietnamese. And he was telling me the same, a similar story where, you know, he would always rebel because he was always being forced to do math. and sciences. But he was more interested in literature and the arts, you know, in languages. For him, his favorite subjects in school were French. And he did French, he did Spanish, I think, and Mandarin. Yeah. So he did a whole bouquet of languages that he was doing. And that was his most loved subject. But growing up in a South Asian family, he was being forced to pursue math, to become a doctor, to become an engineer, to become a scientist. And he says he went through all that, got to university, got a degree, bachelor's in science, and then he left university. Then when he left university, he then went to do a master's in Europe. And whilst he was doing his master's, he said, no, I'm far away from home. I'm going to do my own thing now. Then he took a degree in international relations, and he did languages alongside with it. Now he's working for the United Nations. He's not doing anything related to science. And he was saying that he always got into trouble. He always got into trouble as a younger child. And I think it also ties into what you're talking about. No one even asked, why is it that you don't like to do maths?
Yeah.
What do you love?
I mean, Tukunda, you said he was Vietnamese, yeah. So, yes. That would also be a cultural thing. I mean, you have almost the archetypal South Asian or Southeast Asian family where they have to become a lawyer or a doctor or something like that. And it's there's a lot of great Asian comedies based around those whole topics.
Yeah.
And then, so this kid, was this kid at Prince Edward?
No. I met him. He's much older than me. I met him when I was in university.
Okay.
He was stationed in Namibia at that time.
And he worked for the UN in the end.
Yes, he worked for the UN. So he's even been in Africa, has actually worked. He's actually never lived here as a younger child.
Yeah.
So he lived his whole life in
Vietnam. Interestingly, I do think that his parents pushing him to do to get through school and to get through university is very important. Because I didn't do A levels, I couldn't go to university. As you know, and in your generation, it's even harder to get into uni. You don't even get a foot in the door. So I didn't have a hope in hell of doing anything that was going to bring in much money. I didn't think so. I sort of drifted around for a few years in England. It sounds like you're Vietnamese friend, at least he could get into the United Nations because he had a degree. And that gives you a certain amount of gravitas and kudos, I think. I made that dreadful mistake. Well, I didn't have a choice. I was asked to leave. But, so when I went to England, I had to work as a waiter in a cocktail bar, for a few years before I could qualify for a grant in the UK, before I could eventually go back to university. But again, I could really only do something in the arts, which didn't bother me because by then I was a mature student and I knew what I wanted. But, I would really say to the youth of today to sort of get those qualifications in, even if you hate your parents for forcing you to do it.
Yeah, true. I think
the question is, do we really listen to, do we listen to ourselves or do we listen to people who have been there? Because times are different for each generation, right? Like we spoke about in the moral dilemma, times are really different in all generations. So That's the question we ask. Whatever age we are, we think we're right. We think we know what we're doing. We think that this is the right thing to do. And sometimes the older generation, when they force you to do something, it might not sit well with you, even though it is important to get those qualifications. But if I really feel that, you know what, I want to go for acting auditions. And if I had a choice between going to a math class and an acting audition, I'm definitely going to fight with my parents. right?
Yeah.
And then one of us is going to regret it later in the future. So I don't think there's anything like parenting 101. It's just...
Yeah, but it has a huge effect on the kid. You know, I don't want to knock my dad. He's not around anymore. But, you know, I think when I expressed interest in becoming an actor and wanting to follow in the footsteps of my uncle and aunt, he said over his dead body, well, you know, that's a tough thing to say to your son.
Yeah.
And so I didn't do it. I didn't pursue it because I didn't want to cause this rift. And it wasted so much time in my life because then I decided to do what he wanted me to do, or I thought what he thought I wanted. Oh God, you know. So I ended up going to college to do agriculture, knowing that I was never going to set foot on a farm. You know, and then I went to London and wrote a Dear John letter saying I'm not coming back, you know, and began my life from there in many ways.
But you now, if you put it into context, you know, and there was also this sort of a rift that you're talking about and clashing of your dreams and what your father expected of you. Even what the headmaster expected of you. No one is asking questions. Is there anything, like any sort of, I could say, institutional societal change, you'd say, this could solve certain problems that you experienced? Because from my experience, and my own personal experience, I've also seen a couple of guys I went to school with, the situation is more or less the same. You probably have a little bit more institutional support, but it still remains the same way. People are having to do to pursue degrees, to pursue careers that they don't really like, but their parents want them to achieve those things.
Yeah. Gosh. You know, firstly, you know, I don't want to go away from this podcast with everyone thinking I'm constantly knocking Prince Edward School. I'm not. It's an
please don't.
It's an incredible school, you know, and it is still arguably one of the best in Africa.
Yeah, when we were there, we used to call it the best country in the school. It's more than
the school. Yeah, the best country in the school.
You know, and that whole kind of fraternity you get from Prince Edward School, you know, from being a great sporting school, a great academic school, you know, this lasts throughout your life. And they do teach you some wonderful things, but not everyone's the same. And, you know, when it was fairly obvious I was interested in art and drama, they told me that I had to do it outside of the school. So I did drama, weirdly, at girls' high school. I was the only boy in the class. So I got all the male roles, which was brilliant. You know, it was fantastic. I didn't even have to audition.
Yeah.
and then for art, I did lessons once a week at Peter Birch in Greenwood Park in Harare, was an amazing, amazing creative teacher. So, you know, it was certainly through them that I learnt about the creative side of things, and from my aunt and uncle and people like that. But, you know, Prince Edward, I will say this, their English literature, which is an art, was by far one of the best, in Southern Africa, you know. We had incredible teachers, and I'm very glad about that. So there was this weird thing about Prince Edward, you know, where, you know, English literature was considered okay, but art or drama wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, other than Gilbert and Sullivan, where, you know, I had to play the maiden in distress. And I was in distress.
Yeah, I think it ties in. And I must mention as well, even when we were there, Madeline and myself, we did English literature in our A-levels. And there are really some good teachers at that school. There's some fabulous facilities and, you know, fabulous opportunities as well that can come your way. And like you mentioned, people are different. There's some guys who didn't manage to get that lesson, even if it was still there. And, you know, like you were talking about, like how there are, you know, outside people who can actually support you. I believe it's possible to get those in and around even now, which is quite interesting. I mean, how is it possible that you then find yourself in London? I'm mentioning this because I know you said in your bio you say that you left for the army. I just want to know how was that? How was that experience?
The army?
Was in your army.
Okay. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, from the age of 15 at Prince Edward, I was bullied badly. It only takes two people with influence to start the bullying and start the rumors. And like any school, it goes, spreads like wildfire through the school. You know, they started for no reason, I might add, because there was absolutely no reason to believe it. But they started the whole thing that I was queer, I was a morph. I don't know whether they still use that word back in Zim. You know, and it's a horrible thing to have when you're a teenager. And, you know, you'd be dragged out of bed in the middle of the night, you know, by the other seniors. And it's interesting that most bullying starts with juniors, but with me, it started when I was 15 by one particular guy who I'm not going to mention because he's no longer with us. But he was a terrible, terrible man, the same age as me, and for some reason had a lot of influence with the prefects and the seniors, and they believed him. And so that's how it all sort of escalated. And you were dragged out of bed in the middle of the night, thrown into the cold showers, you know, given the boot, made to run the gauntlet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and it was a horrible time. So the weird thing was that when I got into the army was a so much more grown up place. I was only in the army for a year. I only did my national service. And it was a very interesting time because it was the year that Mugabe came to power. So, you know, our army, the army I went into, ended up the army, I started with Ian Smith's army, I ended up in Mugabe's army. But that's another issue. But I never ever saw any bullying in the army, but I mean, the army's hard. They will beat you up if you're not pulling your weight, which is not bullying, by the way. And, you know, but it was an extraordinary time. You know, you were mixing. I was 17 because I was asked to leave school, remember? I was 17 years old. I was actually underage. And, you know, there were people that I was in my unit who were, you know, in their 40s. You know, twice my age, and so it's an amazing time. But I also realized that, again, it was certainly not a time I was going to say, "Hey, I'm here, I'm queer, and I'm not going shopping." You know, so I sort of shut down entirely during that 1 year, and I felt okay, I can do that because this is only going to last a year. It was an extraordinary experience, you know, in so many ways. And I came out of the whole thing a far better person, a bit more mature. I worked for a short time in Zimbabwe, and then, you know, I decided to go and do agriculture. So I went to do an agricultural course in England. Knowing that I was never going to come back and farm, it was kind of like a way out. Sorry.
Yeah. I guess everyone does look for a way out of Zim in some way, shape, or form. I think it's then and now.
Oh, totally, totally. And you know what? If you play your cards right, if the country plays its cards right, people will come back. And I was talking
yes,
to someone.
Definitely.
I was talking to someone who lived for 25 years in Indonesia. He was, again, a Prince Edward guy. He lived 25 years.
I lived for 5 years in Indonesia, actually.
Ah, okay. you might have crossed paths, you know. But anyway, he lived in the Philippines for about 10 years as well. So he has a real old Asia hand, you know. And he's just recently moved back to Zimbabwe. And he said to me on the phone last week how he does not even think about Indonesia anymore. 25 years of his life, he doesn't even think about it. He loves Zimbabwe so much. And he said the reason why he's loving it so much is because the young people, the 20 to 30 year olds, are starting to filter back, and they are bringing with them the tools of their trade, their creativity, a new way of thinking. He just says it's absolutely a breath of fresh air compared to when we were growing up during a civil war and we were told to be rugged and all of that kind of thing, you know. And he said, it's very different. Obviously, we know, you know, there's yes. huge problems to get over. But, you know, I just think there's something to really look forward to in Zimbabwe.
The potential will always be there.
But then you'd probably be sitting there saying, who am I to say that, sitting in my flat in Hong Kong? And you're absolutely right. I don't have a right to say anything.
No, but I think I have to agree with him. There's a lot of youth which are coming back, and people are occupying spaces that previously were not occupied, which is good to see. I mean, of course, it's not happening the rate we want it to happen, but you still be seeing it here and there. Even in the political arena, there are more and more young people who are actually getting more involved. Even have younger ministers and deputy ministers, which is quite interesting to see.
Yeah, and Tukunda, they are the future, and you didn't even give me that choice to be a 20 to 30 year old sitting in the lifeboat. That's the one I would save.
I know, that's why I didn't give you that.
But, you know, but I just thought it was, despite all of its, you know, the power cuts and the traffic lights not working and that brilliant meme I saw recently on the potholes in Africa. I don't know if you guys saw it. I wish I had it in front of me, but it was just so funny. you know, but there is kind of some hope, I think.
There's always going to be, there always has been, and there always will be hope in Zim. It's just how we can get it. But yeah, it's interesting. Really, yeah, how...
And Dylan, when I go back there, and it's sort of getting rarer and rarer as I get older, but, you know, I was back there in 2018. You know, you forget how friendly Zimbabweans are. I mean, you know, they're just so friendly from the, you know, the Watatu drivers to the, you know, to the shopkeepers, to everyone just so friendly. And yet they've been dealt quite a hard hand throughout history, actually.
Exactly. It's a beautiful country. It's home. Even when you're not from there, it's going to be home. If you're from there or not from there, you always feel like it's home. I've met a lot of Indonesians who've been to Zim and they feel and they know that it's home. Yeah. So, yeah.
Getting very philosophical. Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
and also, the one thing that has not changed from my time to your time to the and hopefully in the future, you know, Zimbabwe has a wilderness that is probably, well, arguably the best in the world because it's untouched. You know, we don't have the tourists that the Great Wall of China has. We don't have the hordes of people. And even Victoria Falls, you know, the greatest asset of all. You know, last time I was at the Vic Falls, which, okay, it was 10 years ago, but that's not too long ago. You know, you could walk the entire length of those falls without bumping into another tourist.
Is it?
I know that's not good for the economy, but it's fantastic for me.
Yeah, it is. You can suck it all in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. But on that note, the conclusion to all this, I would say, is that you're always going to come back home. You're always going to feel like home, no matter where you are and whoever you are. But the question that I have to both of you would be, if you could do it again, would you? Because you've all become a certain person in your life, right? And I think you respect yourselves and love yourselves. Would you go through it again, or would you change things? Because we all know that if you change one small thing, it'll change.
Maybe are we going through it again? Are we going through it again with the same political climate and everything?
Yes.
We're quite everything. Literally doing it all again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't think I could. I don't think I could. I don't, I'm so different now to what I was.
But isn't what you went through make you different? Isn't that the reason why you're different?
Tukunda, you answer that question first. Let me think.
Yeah, I'm sure. After his second question, it's quite interesting.
Well, would I get... Look, there were a lot of people... There was a lot of sadness, a lot of people who died, and, damn, why do you end with a question like that? am I allowed to sort of change who I am, or am I going to go through the whole thing again, being bullied again and all of that? Because if that's the choice, then no, I wouldn't. Okay. But if I could do it again, knowing what I know now, then absolutely I would do it again. I would be a different kind of rebel.
So you'd be a rebel either way. Okay, I'll take that answer.
I have to go with Peter here. I would do it again with what I know now, but I would probably go a step further and change tiny little bit of detail as we go along, because I mean, Peter, what you were talking about, the whole bullying and the whole scenario, it was still prevalent when we were still in high school. I think you cannot eradicate bullying at all, perhaps maybe the extent to it to which it happens, but
especially in old boys school.
Yeah, especially mm-hmm. Especially in old boys school. But I think I would, with what I know now, I would go through it and tweak a little things, just a little bit here and there.
Yeah. Interesting.
Very interesting. I don't know whether I'd be brave enough to do it all again, but hey, bring it on. You know, in the twilight of my life, I'd be willing to give it. Perhaps I would be willing to give it a shot, no matter what happens.
I'd honestly go back for those plays that I was in and wish I'd acted better. <Isn't it>? I remember refusing to wear a dress in one play and refusing to wear makeup. Now I'll be there like, I'm gonna act like the best.
I wanted to ask you guys, so you come from a theater background. So did you do that as a job after school?
No, I didn't. My acting, my theater ended with school.
Okay.
I got to university, I got a bit busy. I remember the first few weeks, I actually wanted to go and join the theater. Then they told me their times, like, for sure, the classroom with my classes. So yeah. After that, I just didn't go back.
But in conclusion, I'd like to maybe summarize all that we've said, which is we're all human beings on different journeys in life. We go through things that the other would never even dream of what we've gone through. I mean, Mr. Wood, you've lived through the 60s, the 70s, and still the 80s, and you're still living now and going through your own life and your own experiences and telling your story, which is a beautiful thing. Takuna and I are the same age, but we're still going through a journey that is still different from everyone else. And between him and I as well, there's still different journey we probably won't understand from each other. But that's what life is, and that's what makes you who you are. And you have to embrace it, love or hate it. It's what you went through. And who are we without our stories anyway? If we didn't have our stories, then would we really be happy with the people we are and, you know, the situations we're in? Life is a beautiful thing. And no matter what you go through, cherish it. But don't forget to communicate and speak to someone. Sit down, listen to what they have to say. Listen to whether they're, no matter how old they are or younger they are from you, communicate. And we all learn from each other at the end of the day. I would like to say that I've learned so much from Mr. Wood in the space of an hour. So thank you very much for your presence.
Well, thank you. I've learned from you guys too.
Yeah.
Yo, 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 yo.